linguistic
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, I guess that by now you've figured out the fact that I've slipped back into a more relaxed schedule for a bit. There are a whole lot of reasons for this, but mainly I need time to do a few other projects I'm involved in, one of which is working with Dennis Berry and Bruce Damer to help find a permanent home for the Timothy Leary Archives, and I'll have more to say about that in my next podcast. Another reason that I don't feel quite so pressed about getting a podcast out every 7 days is that there are now a lot of other great podcasts for the psychedelic community, and by listening to some of them, I almost feel like I'm right here with you in the salon. And then there are the all the forums over on thegrowreport.com that are building our geographically widespread community into a much more tightly knit group on the net. But don't worry, I won't let more than 2 weeks go without a new program, and who knows, there may be spurts of energy that come my way from time to time, and I'll do a couple of week for a while or something. But hey, it's the Psychedelic Salon after all, and I don't know about you, but I've never found anything having to do with psychedelics to be very predictable. But one thing that I have found to be predictable is that our community hangs together even when times are tough. And from what I hear, the financial news from all around the world is pretty glum. Yet, in spite of all the uncertainty going around these past few weeks, John F. and James P. still had enough faith in the world to send donations to the salon to help with the expenses associated with producing and distributing these podcasts. So, thank you very much, John and James. Your help is most definitely appreciated. And now, let's get on with today's program. As you know, a while back I mentioned what was then the upcoming Horizons Conference in New York, New York City, actually, I guess. Well, it turns out that two of our fellow saloners, Patrick and Carl, both of whom also have been past donors here, too. Well, both of them attended the conference after hearing about it here in the salon. And last week, Carl sent me an email with a link to the Internet Archive, where all of the talks had been posted under a Creative Commons license. And I'll have more to say about this very interesting conference at the end of today's program. But first, I want to play two selections from this conference for you, and then you can go to the Internet Archive and download any of the other talks that may be of interest to you. And I'll give you the names of those speakers here at the end of this program as well. Right now, though, I'm going to play selections from two of the presentations to give you a little idea of some of the things that are being talked about at these kinds of events. I have actually edited both of these selections down just a bit, mainly by cutting out the dead space where an audience member's long question couldn't actually be heard very clearly. Now, the first talk I want to play for you is by Robert Forte, who I've known for quite a while now. It seems that the two of us keep bumping into one another in the strangest places, like an island in Canada, a salon in Venice Beach, or at one of John Hanna's conferences. And in case you didn't know it, Robert is also the publisher of several important psychedelic books and is also the editor of Entheogens and the Future of Religion, which is one of my all-time favorite collections of psychedelic essays. And it also includes Terence McKenna's brilliant piece, Psychedelic Society. Actually, I think that's probably his best essay. At least it's my favorite. So, without any further ado, here is Robert Forte speaking at the 2008 Horizons Conference, Perspectives on Psychedelics.
Let me say what a pleasure it really is to be here, and it feels really like a homecoming to me, because actually it was exactly 30 years ago, perhaps to the day, that I began my work in this field. I was a student of religion at Columbia University uptown, and I was interested in religion because I had begun the practice of meditation. Actually, I began the practice of meditation to improve my golf game. And it worked so well that I became interested in the origin and the history of these techniques, and so began to study religion and Indian religion. And I think if word got out that golf was actually a gateway drug, then maybe we would find a problem with the Republican Party. Of course, on the other hand, if it could be discovered that small doses of psychedelic drugs actually improve one's ability to play golf, perhaps we would see a real reclassification of the drugs. So Daniel was so effective, I think, in covering so many things that I had to run home after his talk and re-prepare some of my notes, maybe to get a certain continuity here. Again, I want to just touch upon this Irish gene, I think is so interesting, that in our modern history of psychedelic drugs, we've had Timothy Leary, and then we had Dennis McKenna, and now we have Daniel Pinchbeck. And I hope I'm not offending Daniel by comparing him to Leary, who he made a sort of disparaging comment about, because I want to say a couple things about Tim and the method behind his madness. And I see that there's a kind of lineage in these people that become spokesmen for our movement, and that they keep getting more refined, more intelligent, and I hope more effective. So it was that first day of class at Columbia where we were learning about Indian religion, and our professor mentioned the Vedas. And many of you know that the Vedas are the oldest body of writings in Indian religion. All of Indian mysticism and religion comes out of the Vedas. And he told us that the oldest of the Vedas is the Rig Veda. And the Rig Veda is a set of hymns, poems, that are entirely devoted to the plant, the god, and the drink, Soma, which provided visions of the cosmic order and instructions for humanity on how to live. And something shifted, whether it was the climate or whether it was political, we don't really know, but Soma disappeared. And in India, they needed to devise other ways to come up with these ecstatic experiences, and this is the origin of meditation and yoga and so forth. Now, our professor on this day mentioned that the most convincing theory for the identity of Soma was that produced by a man named Gordon Wasson, an amateur mycologist and Wall Street banker, who has proven to the satisfaction of most Indologists and historians of India that it was a psychedelic mushroom, or I think he said hallucinogenic mushroom. And at that was a real major paradigm shift for me, because although, of course, I had known about psychedelic drugs, I had never heard anyone that I respected attribute any significance to them. You know, I grew up, I'm 51 years old, so I just kind of missed the 60s, and really all I saw about psychedelic drugs was them used in a recreational context in what seemed to me to be a trivial and sort of destructive way. And then here was this professor who was suggesting that, in fact, they were at the origin of what I had known from my own experience were some of the most simple and most profound psychotherapeutic and spiritual practices on the planet. So I remember very clearly that day I left the class and I went and I began reading. I went to the bookstore across the street from Columbia and picked up a copy of The Joyous Cosmology by Alan Watts and Timothy Leary. And it really set me, and I just kept reading and reading and reading. And though I didn't have my first experience until about a year later, after a month of meditation in a Buddhist center. I think I mentioned that because I think it's extraordinarily important. Again, the context, the set and setting that we use these drugs in. And if we're going to succeed in this psychedelic renaissance, you know, that's just something that I think needs to be underlined again and again. So this was not, of course, my first interest in the subject. My first interest in the subject went back to 1968. I'll never forget. I was in fifth grade, and it was current events day. We had to bring something in, and as I was going out the door, there was a copy of Look magazine on the table, and I grabbed it and brought it in. And Look magazine had LSD on the cover, so I brought it in to my fifth grade class, and my teacher, Helen McCloy, The only indication that the 1960s happened in my community, Woodcliff Lake, New Jersey, not very far from here. I asked her, what is this LSD? What does LSD stand for? She kind of had this little sly smile, and she said, "Let's save democracy." Of course, that just went right over my little 12-year-old head, but I mention it because, you know, ever since I've been interested in this subject, these two themes, the religious and the political, have been of great concern to me. But before I get into all that, I want to just tell a story or two that may say a little bit about the ancient history of psychedelic drugs and help define where we are today. The first of these is a story called When the Waters Were Changed. It's a story I picked up in the wonderful book Tales of the Dervishes by Indries Shah. I'm going to read this. But once upon a time, Kadir, I may be saying that wrong, I don't know if Julie's still here to correct me. Once upon a time, Kadir, a teacher of Moses, called upon mankind with a warning. At a certain date, he said, all the water in the world that had not been specifically hoarded would disappear. It would then be renewed with a different water, which would drive men mad. Only one man listened to the meaning of this advice. He collected water and went to a secure place where he stored it and waited for the other water to change its character. On the appointed day, the stream stopped running, the wells went dry, and the man who had listened, seeing this happening, went to his retreat and drank his preserved water. What he saw from his security, the waterfalls again began to flow. This man descended upon the other sons of men. He found that they were thinking and talking in an entirely different way than from before, yet they had no memory of what had happened or of having been warned. When he tried to talk to them, he realized that they thought he was mad, and they showed hostility or compassion, not understanding. At first he drank none of the new water, but went back to his concealment to draw on his supplies every day. Finally, however, he took the decision to drink the new water because he could not bear the loneliness of living, behaving, and thinking in a different way from everybody else. He drank the new water and became like the rest. Then he forgot about his own store of special water, and his fellows began to look upon him as a madman who had miraculously been restored to sanity. The second story I want to tell is a shortened version of Plato's famous story, The Allegory of the Cave. Perhaps you know this. This is in the Republic, and it's about a dialogue with Socrates, and many people say that this is a story about Plato's or Aristotle, Socrates' initiation into the Eleusinian mysteries. Imagine an underground cavern in which there sits, chained to their seats, a number of inhabitants. They've been there their entire lives. In the back of the cave, there's a fire. In front of the fire, a puppeteer playing with marionettes who are dancing puppets in front of the fire. All these people who are chained to their seats their entire life only know the shadows on the wall in front of them. Until one day, one man manages to get free from the chains and turns around and sees the fire and gets out of the cave and comes up and sees the real world. Out of compassion for his brothers and sisters, he returns into the cave and tries to tell them what's really going on. As they have no experience and no knowledge that can validate what this man is saying, they think he too is crazy, and they kill him. So I'm very happy to see, well, I can't see him right now, my old friend, Sasha Shulgin. I thought I heard him laugh back there. And I understand there's a documentary film being made about Sasha, and it's really about time because of all the people that I've known in this field, Sasha's really one of the most courageous and brilliant and funny and important ones. So I'm very glad there's a film being made of him. I'm mentioning him now because I recall a very important talk that Sasha gave at the, it was either at the Humanistic Psychology Conference in 1984 in Boston, or it was at the University of California, Santa Barbara. But Sasha was one of many psychedelic scholars and activists who have pointed out these very interesting coincidences or synchronicities between discoveries and developments in psychedelic drug history and developments in nuclear science, nuclear radiation, that we see this kind of balancing effect going on in our culture. You know, the most dramatic example is perhaps that Albert Hofmann discovers LSD, as you all know, sort of accidentally, just 6 months after the success of the Manhattan Project at the University of Chicago. Science, on one hand, now has the power to basically tear matter asunder, and at the same time, as if nature is somehow balancing herself in an accidental situation over in Switzerland, this man has a peculiar presentiment, he calls it, when he wakes up to investigate this molecule that he discovered 5 years earlier. And now science has a means to kind of put nature back together again, to provide mankind and humanity with this unitive mystical experience. Many scholars have commented on this. I think it was maybe Aldous Huxley who first called LSD the atom bomb to the soul. Frank Baron, who was my teacher and Timothy Leary's initiator, was another one who had devoted his career to somehow trying to counter this savage, destructive property that man had now with the atom bomb by his interest in creativity and in psychedelic drug research. Daniels mentioned this in his work. Leary has. Lots of people have called this out. So I want to mention this because if indeed we're having a psychedelic renaissance, and it seems that we are, it would be no surprise in this context because the crisis that we face now on the earth, whether you're tuned into the environmental crisis, the financial crisis, Daniel or Terrence's 2012 scenario, or if you're like me, concerned with the profound psychological and political crisis that is apparent by the fact that still nearly half of Americans think that Arabs attack the World Trade Center, when it's plainly obvious to millions of people throughout the world and thousands of scientists in this country that that story is patently false, couldn't possibly be true. Or as Terence McKenna puts it in my first book, Entheogens and the Future of Religion, maybe you can tell by just looking around you that the shit will soon hit the fan. We are living in unusual times. I find this coincidentia positorum, a phrase used by my professor, Mircea Eliade, who maybe you know if you've read in History of Religion at all, this meaning coincidence of opposites. It's a very interesting and long history in terms of psychedelic drugs in Western culture. In fact, I would say that arguably the oldest record, the oldest use of psychedelics in our Western culture, let's say, is the Eleusinian Mysteries, which I'm going to talk in some detail about. The Eleusinian Mysteries were a psychedelic drug ceremony that occurred every year for 2,000 years in ancient Greece. This was considered the most important event in your lifetime. If you lived in classical antiquity, it was Cicero who said at the end of the Roman Empire, "Although Athens brought forth numerous divine things, yet she never created anything nobler than those sublime mysteries from which we have advanced from a barbarous and rustic life to a civilized one, so that we not only live more joyfully, but also die with better hope." I think it's interesting to compare these mysteries and this myth of creation to our Judeo-Christian Islamic culture, all of which, of course, emerge out of the same Old Testament. It's important, I think, to examine this myth in the context of our discussions about psychedelic drug policy and research. As Goethe put it, "We cannot solve the problems of the world, but to find out where the problems begin, and then to take our stand within the limits of the intelligible." It seems to me that the authoritarian, dominator, anti-nature, sexist culture of death that defines and seeks to confine our spirit is laid out in this peculiar creation story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Beautiful garden is created, and Adam is put into it, and then he becomes lonely, and Eve is given over to him. And there they are in this garden, and God says, "You can eat anything, you can do anything you want here, except eat this fruit of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil." Another coincidentia positorum. Till the serpent comes around and tempts Eve. Eve says, "No, no, no, we can't eat that. We'll die. God said we'll die." And the serpent says, well, God is lying. You won't die. You'll have a psychedelic experience. Your eyes will be opened. You'll be free. And so they eat the fruit. And what happens? Well, the serpent is right. God's lying. They don't die. Not for another 900 years. They were following their constitutional right to freedom of religion. And then they ended up being cursed for all time. Now, when we compare this story to the model of the Eleusinian mysteries, the myth and the mysteries of Eleusis, we see, I think, what we have in this culture is a need for a recontextualizing, a new set and setting, a new mythology that will define psychedelic drugs and give them a context that we can use them in. And so the Eleusinian mysteries were a ritual reenactment of a story that's told in the Homeric hymn to Demeter. As you may recall, Persephone, the goddess of grain and daughter of the earth, was kidnapped by the lord of the underworld. So enraged and despondent that Demeter was, she threatened to destroy the earth and the whole race of mortals and all the gods. And so this dire crisis, this dire planetary crisis, was about to basically end the world until Hermes, the trickster spirit, intervened and secured the release of Persephone. And so joyous was Demeter for the return of her daughter, I interpret that as the return of her future, that she granted humanity a gift, these mysteries, these mysteries that were based upon a sacred drink, the kikion, that has been identified, again to the satisfaction of many scholars and Greek historians, as an ergot, as a concoction derived from ergot, which contains substances from the same source as LSD. Taking the sting out of death has a very, very profound effect on one's worldview. It brings to mind a story about Albert Einstein, who was once asked, if he had one question to ask of the universe, what would it be? And Albert thought about that for a minute, and he said, is it friendly? Is it a friendly universe? It's a prescient remark for a physicist, a very psychologically sophisticated remark, because psychologists have subsequently found that the difference between the authoritarian personality and the personality that is going to thrive and enable a democratic society is based on this difference in worldview. People who perceive the world as threatening or harsh or unfriendly are going to be inclined toward kind of authoritarian politics, whereas democracy is something that requires an individual to have a profound sense of meaning within themselves and understands this interesting equation between of the microcosm and the macrocosm. This is, in fact, the essence of the method of Timothy Leary and why he so dramatically and overzealously popularized psychedelic drugs. Now, I realize that this conference is largely meant to encourage psychedelic research within the university, and I am all in favor of that. And I want to try to kind of finesse my comments here by acknowledging the importance of Timothy Leary. At the same time, I appreciate that in order to get these substances legitimately used in the institutions in our society where they need to be used, we need to take politics out of this. Timothy's zeal certainly did produce and encourage this backlash of repressive legislation that has put many of our friends in jail, and he made a great many very serious blunders. But at the same time, I think that we're cheating ourselves and not really getting the right a whole picture of what's going on here in contemporary society unless we acknowledge a little bit about what's going on inside of his head. So Timothy Leary came out of a tradition of psychologists in the 1950s that were very concerned with this authoritarian personality. In fact, it's fair to say that the entire discipline of social psychology in our country, the United States, was based on the work of refugee social scientists from Europe, people like Solomon Asch and Eric Fromm and Stanley Milgram, who saw this wave of fascism, authoritarian thinking, totalitarianism sweep through Europe. And they came over here and began to, you know, try to figure that out, and became alarmed, many of them, that the exact same conditions that they had seen in Europe in the 20s and 30s and 40s were in fact beginning to ferment here in the United States. And so there was a great deal of attention paid to this. And you know, and anybody wants to follow up on this, I think one of the most interesting books that that emphasizes what I'm saying here comes from a very unlikely source, and that source is John Dean. John Dean was, of course, President Richard Nixon's personal counsel during his administration, and John Dean has had an awakening, a revelation about that administration, as he did during Watergate, and has been writing very vigorously about the political crisis in America. And I want to call your attention to a book he came out with in 2006 called Conservatives Without Conscience, where he brings up this whole body of research of the social psychologists in the 1950s. And it struck me as so ironic when I read this book, because Dean is saying that this is what's happened in Washington, that we have a psychological crisis, that these people have taken over our government are authoritarians. And he brings up all this research, and he has this one line in there where he says, you know, damn, he laments the fact that these psychologists in the 50s kept to themselves. They didn't publish their findings well enough. It was only, you know, it was like confined themselves to their ivory tower. I find that very ironic because, of course, Timothy Leary is criticized for exactly that. You know, here was a guy who found something that could, if used well, be a rebuke to authoritarianism, that could cause this shift in worldview from a hostile, unfriendly universe to a joyous cosmology and a joyous universe. So it's not surprising that, you know, Dean's boss at that time, President Richard Nixon, called Timothy Leary, of course, the most dangerous man in the world. And this is why, because they knew that Leary had his finger on the psychopathology of what was going on there. And Nixon's, you know, outrage was really a form of psychological resistance. Tim was himself, the CIA attempted to recruit Timothy Leary in the 1950s and Frank Barron, his teacher, as part of a wide-ranging program called Operation Mockingbird, which was a vast mind control operation that was being perpetrated on the American nation following the lead of what happened in Germany years before. When Tim realized what was going on here, that the CIA was actually infiltrating publishing and media and universities and other industries to create this hostile, fear-based Cold War mentality to subjugate people to this what George Bush later called the New World Order, he knew that he had to do something equally radical to thwart this threat. Frank Barron went into the psychology of creativity, and Tim went into a kind of anti-authoritarian psychotherapeutic and psychological diagnostic strategies. And when Frank first found the mushroom, he realized that this was the thing. This was going to be the Holy Grail. He came back and told Tim about it. Tim was at first very opposed, and, you know, it's be funny to look at these things that he said. You know, he told Frank, don't talk like this. You're going to lose your scientific reputation. You know, you'll be laughed out of the academy. I'm not going to fuck around with any mushrooms. But finally, it took him a year, but he prevailed, and the rest is kind of history. You know, Tim, in a very short amount of time at the Psilocybin Project at Harvard, did these things that we are hoping to do now using appropriate scientific methodologies and naturalistic observations. He showed that psychedelic drugs were safe. He showed their clinical effectiveness. They showed their effects on enhancing creativity. And he got more and more outrageous, and then we see this kind of dialectic happening. Now, I'm rushing here a little bit because, you know, I realized when I came up here that we're kind of at cross purposes. You may be interested in what I have to say from all the stuff that I've been studying and the people I know, but I remain a psychedelic researcher, and what is most interesting to me are the people that are in the psychedelic movement and what they think. So I have some material here to discuss, you know, methodologies for maximizing the effect of psychedelic drugs, and I could carry on about some of that stuff, but it would be It'd be most interesting to me to hear some of what is on your mind. I know we have a wide variety of people here, like we do often in psychedelic conferences, which reminds me of one objection I have to Daniel's talk. The only thing I take issue with is where he said that this is the first time that we can have a conference like this. Well, that's simply not true. There have been psychedelic conferences. I organized an enormous one in 1981, and there have been major conferences almost every year since then. And this is, again, to kind of credit Leary, because there truly does exist this vast underground network of people who know full well the potential and the grandeur of these substances. So here we are, and what can we do? I'm gonna stop there, and let's have a conversation. Let's talk later about that, okay? I'll just say this, that in my studies, I'm trying to see if there is a relationship between one's psychedelic experience and their susceptibility to the propaganda of the administration. In other words, I'm curious if Leary was right, and that by seeding a population with psychedelic experiences and changing enough worldviews, if they would be less susceptible to the political crisis like that. If there's a tendency for people who have had profound psychedelic experiences where you can perhaps see the world dissolve into a sea of love and understand that your role in the creation of experience, if that gives you a little more freedom and autonomy from pre-programmed information. But that's a very good question. I think we should talk about that. My short answer for that is to do it out of the... He's asking for advice or suggestions on how one can engage themselves in legitimate scientific inquiry of psychedelic drugs. You know, I was in Peru just a couple months ago speaking at a conference there, and it was the first time in my 30 years in this world that it was legal to talk about, to not only talk about, but to consume these materials. In fact, ayahuasca, you may know, has just been declared by the Peruvian government to be part of its cultural patrimony, is their phrase, which basically nails it as a cultural treasure. And so we can follow the lead of a civilized country like Peru and do something like that. I'm beginning to embark upon a kind of medical, anthropological study of ayahuasca and its effects on cancer. So I encourage people, my students, to look into the field of medical anthropology. That if we confine ourselves only to the methodologies that are given us by Richard Nixon in the Controlled Substances Act, it's going to take a very long time, but that there are lots of other possibilities. I want to also call your attention to Richard Boyer's work in the Center for Cognitive Liberties, and that gives another model. I'll talk with you more about that, too. Thank you. Thank you.
And before I forget it, that talk by Sasha that Bob Forte just referred to was the one that Sasha gave at the Santa Barbara conference in 1983. And you can hear that in my podcast number 100 here in the Psychedelic Salon. And I also hope that you get a chance to read some of the essays in Robert's book, Entheogens and the Future of Religion. It just may have an idea or two that you're looking for that may spark your own psychedelic renaissance. That's a great concept, by the way, don't you think? A psychedelic renaissance. Now that is what the world really needs at this particular moment in time. But at this very moment in time, we are going to get to hear from two people who, as much as any other two people alive today, have sparked a psychedelic renaissance. And you know who I'm talking about, Anne and Sasha Shulgin, who entertained the crowd at the Horizons Conference with another edition of their famous Ask the Shulgins session. But this one began with a question I've never heard Sasha answer in public before. And that has to do with a certain annual gathering at the Bohemian Grove, a place close to the hearts of many conspiracy theorists. In fact, Sasha's participation with the Grove even sparked a recent thread on our forum over at thegrovereport.com that was questioning whether or not Sasha was part of the Illuminati. In fact, I've got to remember to send him a copy of that thread because I know it'll give him a few laughs. Anyway, I'll let you be the judge as to whether or not Sasha is part of a group intent on changing the world, or whether he just has a good excuse to get away with the boys for a big party every summer. In fact, you could probably think of Bohemian Grove as Burning Man for old Republicans. And I hope you also please take note of the fact that Sasha, along with Anne, also attends Burning Man every year. So now let's join Anne and Sasha Shulgin, two pillars of the new psychedelic renaissance.
Oh, sorry. What about the Bohemian Grove?
Were you actually seen at Bohemian Grove?
I was up there this year again, yes. Bohemian Grove is kind of a neat little retreat up in the Russian River area. And during the weekends, it's maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people. But during the week, there are only about 200 or 300 people. It's a delightful place, no radios, no television, just quietly sit over there. And you can start the whole day with a beautiful Bloody Mary and end up with a little red wine, which is a delightful way of spending 2 weeks.
He's actually been a member of the club for, 40 years?
Oh, almost 1 year short of 50 years now.
Okay.
He's
it's not just Republican conservatives.
Oh, no, 85% Republican conservatives. It's a very ex-president, Republican presidents, of course. And no president while he's in office has ever been at the Grove, because no president in office is ever off the record. And everything in the Grove is off the record. And so it's a very nice place to see ex-presidents. My first ex-president I ever met there was a fellow named Herbert Hoover. This is some probably before many of your time. But he was a very nice person. He had retired from the presidency. And he gave a lakeside talk, the way I met him was this lakeside talk, where you go down to the lake and you give a talk for 25 minutes. And the name of the talk was the... something to do with
I think it was politics, although politics of fly fishing. I've been married to him for 27 years, so I've heard all these over and over again.
What's the politics of
fly fishing?
Of fishing. The politics of fishing. He loved fishing. And he was an ex-president, so I thought the politics of fishing would be using fishing as an analog for political goings-on. And no, he used the political goings-on as an analog of how you catch fish. Delightful talk. Totally unexpected. A very interesting person. He died next year. I'm
okay,
sorry. More
it.
Questions.
Oh, then...
Did Sasha help with the transformation of Attorney General Mitchell at Bohemian Grove?
Well, I have made a couple of little plays of playing the role of a waiter at the club. It's a very nice way of meeting people who don't know you. And you can make all kinds of wise-ass comments. And they are offended by the fact you're employed here and making these nasty comments. But then someone tips them off that you've actually been a member for 50 years. You're getting away with it. You know, actually, the Bohemian Grove is a very delightful. The whole Bohemian Club is known primarily as a bunch of ex-important people, Republicans, of course. But there's a small percentage, about maybe 20%, who are in there, as I have been for lots of years, because I play the viola. So I'm in the orchestra. And the orchestra, they don't have any waiting time to come in. Normally it's a 10-year wait to become a member, and something like a $25,000 membership fee or something horrible. But when you come in as a musician, you come in for a year of trial, and you play in your orchestra for a while. And if they like the way you play, and you like them, and you can fit along with a crowd, and you spend a year and you haven't really made any trouble, then you're in as a member, and it doesn't cost you a penny. Just a very, very delightful way out.
Despite all the mythology about Bohemian Club, it's mostly about music. Yeah. Actually, that's what goes on most
music
of the time.
Music and art and play.
Yeah, that's okay.
Shows, writing shows, designing costumes,
right.
That kind of thing.
Okay, next question.
Oh, next question.
Okay, another question. I think everybody heard that. Which one has had the most profound effect, or do they enjoy the most?
Personally, I think my most keen friend amongst the various phenethylamines and alkaloids I've worked with and synthesized has been 2CB. It's to me a very, very favorable, very warm, very comfortable compound. I don't use any compound more than a couple, three times because I want to keep a rather virgin liver for developing new compounds and getting them in there and finding what they do. I'm now in a group of compounds called the flies, which is fascinating. They're the pseudoflies and the semiflies and flies and dragonflies. They're all compounds with a couple of rings on each of the two rings. On the middle ring, have a couple more rings on them. And they're substituted in various ways. And they are proving to be extremely versatile in amounts of potency and amounts of activity. And I am finding them very fascinating to explore. And that's what I'm currently working on pretty much all my time.
I should add that we're beginning to hear from various sources that one of the dragonflies is to be avoided. It's what's that?
Well, I think the dragonflies are active at less than a milligram in potency. Yes, whereas the flies are active in the. 10 or there are about 10 to 20 milligram levels.
I was talking to somebody out on the steps just a few minutes ago. I think if you turn on Arrowwood, and probably all of you know that particular site, they are completely reliable, and they'll give you information about what's on the street and different reactions to it. Your main question is basically what's our favorite compound? Yeah, I used to answer that one honestly, and I'm not going to do it anymore because there's a particular one that has an effect on me. And no comments, please. That's exquisitely exquisite. But after I had mentioned that at a few conferences, suddenly everybody was trying this, and most of them were bored stiff. It did not have the same effect on anyone else as it did on me, which is fine. That means there's more for me to use. But everyone's chemistry is different. And so if you say this is my favorite, it doesn't mean anything for anybody else. So everyone has to choose their own ally.
Well, I have to be a little careful on who I tell the structures and the identities of compounds, too. I had an occasion, was it about 2, 3, 4 years ago, with 5-methoxy-dalt. A friend of mine on the East Coast was asking, what am I working on? I said 5-methoxy-dalt right now. I just finished it up. I've written a 2 or 3 page thing for the third book on 5-methoxy-dalt. And what is it? So I sent him the 3 pages I had written. Synthesis, activity in man, biological activity, pharmacology, the usual biochemistry thing. And he said, oh, that's kind of neat. And he put that thing in his website. And he said 1 week afterwards he took it off the website because it was obviously being copied by a lot of people. 3 weeks later, that's 4 weeks after I sent it to him, it had been synthesized in China and sent to this country by way of Holland. In 4 weeks, it was still not in the literature. Yeah. I've never been published. Yeah. So the authorities don't know technically how to synthesize it, but it's all over the European field almost within 4 weeks. Yeah. So I'm a little hesitant about telling. I just publish and let people have the published information.
Yeah.
Other questions? When Ann does therapy using psychedelics with clients, does she also take psychedelics to help them with their mishigas? It's a technical term.
The last time I did a psychedelic psychotherapy as a lay therapist was before we started writing PCAL, the first book. I soon discovered that you can't do that and do that kind of therapy and also write. It was impossible. The material that a hypnotherapist friend of mine and I used was mostly MDMA, which is the most remarkable insight drug, and it's a superb tool for psychotherapy. But I heard from a lot of the therapists at that time, this was in the 70s, a lot of them would take the MDMA themselves with the patient. I did that twice and then realized that, first of all, I was wasting a good experience because you can't pay attention to your own insight when you're paying attention to a patient's insights. It was a waste of the compound and of everything else. And the reason for a therapist taking it was that they were not relying enough on their own natural instincts and insight. They felt for a while they had to have the MDMA to sharpen their perceptions. And it's not true, because any drug, including MDMA, is the most it can do is open up what's inside you already. And I think all but about one that I know of stopped taking any material with their patients. For one thing, it's a selfish thing to do. You cannot be a good therapist while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Sir. So the question, given the obvious vitality of Ann and Sasha, it raises the question of body load and neurotoxicity, especially with MDMA documented as being neurotoxic. And so have they correlated the neurotoxicity of any of the novel substances that you've created with their neurotoxicity? And then in terms of your personal lives, how have you kept yourself so healthy with yoga or exercise, or what is your regimen?
Well, let me start with this new one. As far as correlating physiological, psychological difficulties with MDMA, I know there's a lot of writing about this, but there's an immense amount of writing that does not indicate that. I think it's a few extraordinary bad trips or physiological, psychological problems that get all the notoriety and all the press. So I don't think there's a believable correlation of neurological problems with MDMA use. Personally, I'm not a user of MDMA. I'm not a user of any regular drugs. My art is finding new ones. And if I kept stacking up on MDMA all the time, I'd lose my function of my liver and my responses. So I am a little bit more conservative in regular. I'm not a regular drug user, except for a little red alcohol occasionally. But basically,
red wine.
Okay, let's carry on.
When MDMA was pretty new on the scene, I found that its best use for me was in writing. All my parts of Pical, the first book, were written under the influence of MDMA. That was my writing material. It was not known at that time that if you use MDMA, this is a generalization, but I think it's pretty close to the truth. If you use MDMA more than, let's say, 4 times a year maximum, it won't be too long before you find out it doesn't have its magical effect anymore. since I was using it once a week for at least a year, I found that I was beginning to take a dosage of around 250 milligrams with 150 supplement. And I realized that was a little overdoing it. So I stopped it completely, no difficulty. But I have not been able to use MDMA since. aside from the fact that it's illegal, of course. I did try it once about a year after I'd stopped, and it had a depressive effect, which is completely opposite of what it usually was. So I haven't tried it since. I would very much like to try it once more and see if there's a difference. But
you're covered. Your response.
It's a wonderful drug. I believe in it, in its value for psychotherapy, absolutely. As far as psychedelics, because MDMA is not a psychedelic, as far as psychedelics go, we take less of them now than we used to, because we don't have as much energy as we did when we were in our 30s and 40s and 50s. And also, we don't have enough time. We're too damn busy.
It's as if you burned out one of the receptors or whatever it was that MDMA is active at, and it doesn't repair.
Oh, MDMA, but the psychedelics.
Oh, no, in general, yes.
We don't take enough of them. And when I have not had a good psychedelic trip for, let's say, 6 months, I begin to feel that I'm beginning to get out of balance. I get too irritable. My general view of life gets grouchy, and
I love her anyway.
Then, if I have a chance at a good trip, I feel revitalized, frankly, physically as well as mentally. I think that instead of regarding psychedelics as a drain on the system, frankly, they are my favorite vitamin. That's the effect they have on me.
How do you define consciousness, and how much of it is determined by chemistry?
Well, that's not a question. I consider consciousness where you are if you're alive. And a lot of people put it as a brain function. I consider consciousness as a mental function. And it's there all the time. I mean, you may be sound asleep, but you're dreaming and there's a consciousness there. You may be awake and you may not remember what you dreamed. And for all I know, there are 3 or 4 or 7 lives going on that I don't remember, either awake or asleep. But I feel consciousness is my relationship, a living relationship with the world. And so I don't think it's a matter of being conscious or unconscious. I think when you're unconscious, you're conscious in a different way. I really believe you're part of the system. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think while we're in human form, everything is chemistry. Everything is physics or chemistry, or you know, that's part of the human life. The question of whether consciousness exists after death, I'm absolutely sure it does, but people have different opinions on that. It also depends on what you mean by consciousness. You know, do you mean essential knowingness? You can go down the list. Chemistry, while we're human, and nothing to do with chemistry when we're out of the human phase.
I remember one time I was on an experiment. I forget the chemical, it doesn't matter. But as I was, in fact, you were with me. We were together. And I was looking at the clock because it was interesting to see the second hand of the clock going around. And as I was watching the second hand of the clock, it was going slower and slower and slower. And then it began almost, it went around to 15 seconds, 16 seconds, 17 seconds. My God, it's going to stop. And it occurred to me, if the clock were to stop, what defines death? And suddenly I realized I had taken a chemical that was causing the clock to slow down continuously. And we were both watching the clock. And
well,
said,
we were making the second hand to slow down.
Yeah. And you know, suddenly we commented, made some comment, and we both snapped around out of it, and the clock went normally again.
No. He chickened out. He chickened out, and I think it's a very interesting question, though. If we had actually made that secondhand stop, and we were very, very close to it, I think we wrote about that in the second book. It was a very interesting experience. The material was something called marijuana. And I think we'd taken, a relative of mine had given us brownies of the pot type. And that was, I think marijuana is the greatest drug for fooling around with time. There's no question. And we almost stopped that clock. I don't blame Sasha, but I would kind of like to seen what happened after the secondhand quit. Okay.
I'm glad we didn't.
Other questions? Robert. Okay, so Robert asked the ontological question, similar to what Dan Merker was talking about earlier about true hallucinations versus pseudo-hallucinations. In some of these experiences, we feel like we're in touch with another world, another dimension. And so what's your opinion? Is that real or is it internal?
Well, but from my personal point of view, I find that the psychedelic experience is not something that's imposed upon me. It's something that's going on all the time inside of me. I'm just not aware of it. I have not stopped to think about it. So my belief is that when you get involved in a psychedelic experience, you are in a communication with part of yourself that had, you've given up trying to communicate with, or you've forgotten about communicating with. So it's not something that's imposed by a drug. It's something that's the drug allows you to experience and to function with. So I look upon it as being a revealing thing from within myself rather than a thing imposed upon myself by an external drug.
Yeah, we once were called to Australia for a trial where we had to define hallucination. I forget what our definition was, but hallucination... sorry about that. Is where you are seeing things that are not visible or experienceable by the rest of the people around you. And you have forgotten that you took a drug. Now, if you are aware of the fact that what you're looking at is the result of having taken a drug, then that's not a real hallucination as far as we're concerned.
Well, I hold the term hallucination to be an improper word for this. To me, the term hallucination is being aware of something that does not exist. And this happens with me. Scopolamine is a good example of a true hallucinogen. And I remember one time, I think we were together. And maybe before we got together. This one person... had taken scopolamine in the apartment I was living in Berkeley at the time, and he came out of the kitchen and walked across in front of me and into the door that led to where the piano was, and he ran right into the door, and I went over, "Are you okay?" "Oh yeah, I just was seeing where she was going," and he saw this young lady walking across the room, and he was following her to see where she's going. And she went through this door that was not open, and he went into the door. And then he backed away, and a true hallucination. You see something that was not at all there. And later on, he wanted to lie down for a while and maybe catch a little nap. He didn't catch a nap at all. He wanted to go downstairs and follow the cars that are driving by on the street and see what's going on. He did not remember any of this. When he finally sober up enough to drive home, I found out that he had driven across the bridge. And on the other side of the Bay Bridge, where the towers are, he began talking to this fellow riding with him, who had been in medical school with him. And the fellow hopped into the back seat, and he looked in the back seat, and the fellow disappeared. Oy. So what he did, he said, "I'm going to turn up the radio a little bit." He said, "We'll turn up the radio to get the music louder." And the radio was not even on. And he realized he's not out of this hallucination thing yet. And he got into San Francisco, parked the car, and took a taxi home. And I asked him a couple, 3 weeks later, how long did this last? When did it finally clear up? He said, how can you tell? So, this so this to me is the definition of a hallucination. With the psychedelics, you don't have this. You have the imagery, the self-interpretation, the ease of exploring things you had forgotten.
Well, wait a minute. We haven't had that because we usually don't overdose. And, a part of the answer to someone else's question is how do you keep alive and healthy when you're doing this kind of research, Sasha has a way of, with a new compound, he starts at a nanogram, if necessary, as far down as you can imagine, at a point where it couldn't possibly be active. And then he gradually, over days and weeks and months, works it up so that this way you become pretty quickly aware of neurological complications or flattened emotions, anything like that. And if you get certain symptoms, either physical or mental, you quit. You don't. It doesn't go any further. Now, this kind of caution keeps us alive and well. I think that what was happening with that young man was he was probably overdosed. We've just never taken doses that large, but I think when you do, you probably have some real hallucinations. As far as the possible reality of what you're experiencing, I think sometimes we do tap into concurrent or alternate realities.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite sure that happens, but there's no proof of it.
No.
Other questions? So the question is about the rewards and challenges of doing this sort of growth experience with your partner, with a couple, and how sometimes they're not in the same space, and of course it can be rewarding as well. What about your experience?
I think when you take psychedelics together, you become very aware of the ties you have to the other person. If there are places in your relationship that are not solid, you become aware of them. Sharing the same reality or the same images, that's very rare, but it can happen and it does happen. Most of the time you find you're having quite different imagery, and that's fine, you're two different people. They don't have to be the same. The fact is, I think it's very important to recognize and accept and love the differences between you. And your trips are going to be different. But there is a certain experience I think probably a lot of you have had where you find yourself becoming one entity. And this happens with making love. And you find yourself not only together that way, but you are connected all over the world with other people experiencing the same thing the same way. It's a magnificent experience.
Mm-hmm. That brings us to the close of our Q&A session with Sasha and Anne. I want to thank them very much.
Thank you. You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Well now, between Anne, Sasha, and Robert Forte just now, we have been exposed to a lot of interesting ideas, some of which I'm now seeing from a new point of view. I don't know about you, but I'm going to have to go back and listen to both of those presentations again right now just to recapture a few of the things they said. There's just that much there, I think. And I also think this is a good place to thank the producers and all those who spoke at and worked on the 2008 Horizons Conference. Although I wasn't able to attend in person, thanks to the event promoters, many of these great talks are available for free download at the Internet Archive. And the direct URL is a little too long to read here, but you'll find a link to it on our program notes page. The speakers from the conference whose talks are already posted there where you can download include Alan Hunt Badner, who is co-editor of Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, Robert Forte, who we just heard, but there's a little bit more Q&A that I didn't have time to put in today. Dan Merker, who's a psychoanalyst and author of The Ecstatic Imagination. Daniel Pinchbeck, who you already know from here in the salon. David Nichols, founder of Hester Research Institute and distinguished chair in pharmacology at Purdue University. Dimitri Mobengo Mugianis, and I hope I'm close to a pronunciation that's fair to you there, who is an Ibogaine therapist. And, of course, Anne and Sasha Shulgin's full Q&A session are up there. And I noticed that there's also a talk posted there by Dr. Roland Griffiths, who is the researcher at Johns Hopkins, who's made the news quite a bit lately. And so a big thank you to the producers of the Horizon Conference for making so much material available under the Creative Commons license. Your work to help our community grow and learn is greatly appreciated. Now, I've got a couple emails that came in I think may be of interest to you and some of our fellow saloners. The first one comes from the Guyan Soldier, who says in part, "Hi, Lorenzo. Hope all is well at your end of the line. Once again, thanks for all of your great work. I know you'd get it all the time, but you really have changed my life and the way I view reality, although a lot of it has also been from our beloved sacraments. But all the same, you keep my flame alight for the cause. Just the fact that you are doing these podcasts, and by some divine intervention, they somehow ended up on my computer. It's funny the way things work sometimes, hey? Well, let me stop here for just a moment and say that while I normally don't read the parts of emails that are thanking me for doing these podcasts, it doesn't mean that your words of appreciation don't mean a great deal to me. What the Guyan Soldier just said just now is along lines similar to many of the messages I receive. And I know that this is true also for KMO, The Dope Fiend, and all the other podcasters out there who do this as a labor of love, our love for this wonderful community of free thinkers who are gradually finding one another here in cyberspace. So from all of us podcasters, hey, thanks again for your kind words and thoughts. That's really what keeps us going. Now, back to the Guyan Soldier's email. The reason I'm writing to you this time is to get your advice on starting my own podcast series, mainly on the content and rules of talking about such things deemed illegal. My aim is to be the medium for which people of the everyday consumer lifestyle can start to be influenced by the Psychedelic Salon. I found a lot of the people I've shown the lectures to seem to not have the time for it, or they plain just don't understand what's being said. Don't get me wrong, I'm in no way trying to copy or plagiarize the Psychedelic Salon in any way, just to capture their attention and refer on to the bigger picture, you know. Well, Guyan Soldier, I'm 100% behind your efforts, and it is very reassuring to see that more and more people in our community are beginning to put their time and talents toward creating a truly wide range of programming. And I think it's very important to continue building our interconnecting webs of ideas and audiences from as many different points of view as we can handle. Already, I'm learning a lot about what's going on from Sancho and Cody's Black Light in the Attic podcasts, and there isn't a program on dopefiend.co.uk that I don't listen to regularly. And, Pothead's Coffee Shop, guess who showed up there today? You need to go listen to that one. I was really pleasantly surprised to hear your guest DJ this morning. And I've learned from all these, too, I might add. I've probably bought more books after hearing KMO interview the author than from any other interviewer. Because, first of all, he's one of us, and so he seeks out authors who appeal to our interests. You know, and then there are the podcasts from Tom Barbalay, Martin Ball, and Dr. Dave, and they're all doing things like that, just to mention a few of them. And, of course, now I've gotten into Reverend Zeke's Behind the Eyelid shows. Now, I don't mean for this very incomplete list of podcasts that I listen to discourage you from beginning your own show. My point here is that there's a huge audience out there who still has no idea that the worldwide psychedelic community exists. And I'll be the first to agree that trying to convince somebody to listen to a lecture here in the psychedelic salon isn't, that's not the best way to let younger people know that they'll find some like-minded spirits here. So let your creative juices flow and help us find the others. Now, as to your main question, which has to do with talking about substances that are illegal, one of the first things I should point out is that not every kind of free speech is protected. For example, it's not legal to yell fire in a crowded theater. And I don't know if it's actually legal to say where to find an illegal substance, but in my book, it would be really stupid on all kinds of levels. You know, in some of the salons out here on the West Coast, the physical on-the-ground ones, we generally have a hard and fast rule that there's no buying, selling, and no talking about buying or selling any illegal substance. It's not permitted, or using them at the salon. And even though there have been several times when law enforcement goons have infiltrated our gatherings, since nothing illegal was being discussed or done, they quickly lost interest in our monthly get-togethers and left us alone. I guess none of that was very much help just now, but just use your common sense, and you shouldn't go wrong. In another email, Dervish Mad Whirler writes, "Lorenzo, isn't it time for some Terrence again? I haven't heard any for a while now, apart from the talks I've heard already. All these other people are exactly the mentalization, the rationalization that has plagued the psychedelic society since Terrence died. A great step backwards in understanding the inner worlds. Endless debates and rehashing of the same old white man's ego-based understanding of reality, of male head-based reality. Why not some Terrence again? Why not some Amazon shaman or some new ideas? I haven't heard any new ideas in years." Well, you're not alone, Whirler. I've been getting a lot of requests for more Terrence McKenna lately, and I still have several yet unheard trilogue tapes that Ralph Abraham gave me to play here in the salon. And I'll get one of those out soon, but next week I'll be playing another talk from the Timothy Leary Archive, and hopefully also be able to announce some new news about the physical archive of Dr. Leary's work. So please stay tuned, as they say in Radioland. Now, in just a minute, I'll be giving my usual spiel about where to find the program notes, but first I want to let you know what you'll be hearing right after I sign off. It's a little piece put together by a fellow saloner, Waking Sleep, whose blog you can find at wakingsleep13.livejournal.com. I just found out about this over in one of the forums at thegrillreport.com, where he said, "In 2 weeks, I'm going to be going to an event in Delaware called Playa del Fuego, which is described as the burning event of the Mid-Atlantic region. What I plan on doing is handing out copies of this project on CD, including a link to the Psychedelic Salon website and the Sea Realm, just for good measure. Hopefully I can introduce some new people to the amazing mind of Terrence McKenna and maybe bring some new listeners to the Salon and the Sea Realm. Anyway, I thought I'd provide a link to that part of the project I have finished." And so I downloaded it, listened to it, liked it, and asked Waking Sleep if it was okay to use it here in the salon. And here's part of what he had to say. "Thanks so much for listening to my project and responding. I'm glad you liked it. I had done something similar with a few other tracks, but I couldn't have really put those out there because the tracks had traditional copyrights on them. But when Nine Inch Nails put out the instrumental album under a Creative Commons license, I knew it presented a really cool opportunity to spread McKenna's ideas around to people who might not otherwise listen to him. I'm working on other tracks, and I would still like to keep taking parts from that same talk. It's one of my favorites. Funny, though, how I started with the end. I would also like to continue with doing this with other talks, not just from McKenna, though I'm going to have to search around for some good CC-licensed music. I'll run out of tracks from the Ghosts album pretty soon. Well, thanks for putting this track together, Waking Sleep, and also thanks for spreading the word about the Salon and the Sea Realm podcast. I should point out that Waking Sleep also said something about making a donation sometime in the future, but hey, you're already doing more than your share. You know, it's all about spreading the word, and your project is most certainly doing that. So thank you, and thank you to all the rest of our fellow Saloners who are also working on projects like this. And also, I definitely want to thank Nine Inch Nails for putting some of their music online to be used without paying a royalty in non-commercial projects like this. The album in particular is called Ghosts, and it's all instrumental and is licensed under the same license that these podcasts are licensed under, namely the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about the details of that license, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org, and that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.
Vehicle and redesign it into a kind of starship that would carry carry us and our children out into the broad starry galaxy we know to be waiting us. But it's a cultural test. Nature is pitiless. Intelligence is a grand experiment upon which a great deal has been risked. But if it proves inadequate, nature will cover it over with the same kind of cool impunity that she covered over the dinosaurs and the trilobites, the crossopterygian fishes, and all those other folks who came before.
Feels itself to be sick, it begins to produce antibodies.
jazz, experimental dance, rave culture, tattooing. The list is endless. What do all these things have in common? They represent various styles of rejection of linear values. The society is trying to cure itself by an archaic revival, by a reversion to archaic values. So when I see people manifesting sexual ambiguity, or scarifying themselves, or showing a lot of flesh, or dancing to syncopated music, or getting loaded, or violating ordinary canons of sexual behavior, I applaud all of this, because it's an impulse to return to what is felt by the body, what is authentic, what is archaic. And when you tease apart these archaic impulses, at the very center of all these impulses is the desire to return to a world of magical empowerment of feeling.
Thank you. late. The clock is ticking. We will be judged very harshly if we fumble the ball. We are the inheritors of millions and millions of years of successfully lived lives and successful adaptations to changing conditions in the natural world. Now the challenge passes to us, the living, that the yet to be born may have a place to put their feet and a sky to walk under. And that's what the psychedelic experience is about, is caring for, empowering, and building a future that honors the past, honors the planet, and honors the power of the human imagination. Program of a living world and a re-empowerment of the imagination.